On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, one and all, those of you not out busily tending the barbecue fire or the smoker or whatever you may be doing on this holiday Monday, this long weekend Monday. I mentioned Friday that I plan to be on the air this evening, and I am here in fulfillment of that pledge. And glad to have you along if you are as well. Or by podcast. It's, you know, it's all easy, however you prefer it. I'm Bob. This is The Horn. It is Memorial Day 2011. See, that way you know that I wasn't trying to slip one past you and make it a rerun, only you didn't know it. Full candor here. This is candid conversation radio. It's the beginning of my last normal week for a while. And I want to get the program started with a couple of, well, just sort of doing some, I may do this every night this week. Some basic reinforcement of what things are going to be going down in the fairly near future. This is my last normal week for a while because we're going to be very, very busy in the month of June. To expand upon that theme, come next week on the 7th, I will go in the company of a lot of other good people. Folks like Bo Webb and Maria Gano and Alan Johnson from Christians for the Mountains and, myself and a number of other folks, Reverend Jim Lewis. We will all be going to Washington, D.C. To call attention to the hard work of the Environmental Protection Agency. In being the only governmental agency interested in protecting Appalachia from the ravages of the corporate profiteers. So that's going to eat up the 7th, 8th, and probably 9th. On the 10th, we're going to have something really cool here in the Mountain State, you know, almost level West Virginia. Bobby Kennedy Jr. is coming to Charleston to premiere his new film, The Last Mountain. It has not been shown to an open-door audience in West Virginia before, so that'll be taking place on the night of the 10th, so no show on the 10th. You see what I mean about this being the last normal week for a while? Then the following week begins our long 1,000-mile trek to Minnesota for Netroots Nation. We will try to do some broadcasting from there, but it's anybody's guess as to whether we'll be able. Watch this space, as they say. Keep an eye on my Twitter feed and my Facebook page, and you'll be the first to know, right after I know. But that'll take us from the 13th of June to the 20th of June. Returning on the 20th, we will have a modicum of normality, if you will. But then on the 28th of June, we're gone again. But remember, from the 28th of June, or actually the 29th of June, from the 29th of June until the 14th of July, something very, very incredibly special is coming your way. And that is Dr. Bill O'Brien's PRISM West Virginia series on American history. The single best antidote to made-up stuff that the right wing is so fond of pumping into our body politic and our body social, body cultural, that you are you can find in one place. These are going to be all day long, massively intensive, deep detail lectures on various and sundry facets of the founding of the nation and up into the early 1800s. And you do not want to miss this. It will be live on both our Horn audio stream and our Ustream page. You can view the segments on the Ustream page after it's happened at your leisure. You don't have to be watching live, although it'll be cool if you are. And that will take all day, every day of June the 29th, the 30th, and July the 1st, and then July the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, and then the 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th. So all told, that gets us up to the middle of July. You can see what I'm saying about things not being terribly normal for a while. Now, having said all of that, that means I'm going to be away from the microphone for a good bit, which means that I'm not going to be sitting here going hammer and tongs at the need to fundraise. And I told you a few nights ago that I'm more than a little bit nervous about that. And I say so with good reason. Before the show started this evening, what with this being the next to last, the penultimate day of May 2001, use one of them fancy $10 Latinate words, I did the tallying up, and we are pulling up right at $700 short of meeting our fundraising goal for the month of May. In other words, tonight we need 35 people to join the Thrifty 250 or be part of the monthly Thrifty 250, and we need 35 people tomorrow. Of course, if we could get 70 people to do it tonight, I would spend the entirety of tomorrow night not saying a word about any of this, and you have no idea how overjoyed I would be to do so. But, January, February, March, and April, and we squeaked it right under the wire a couple of times, we managed to hit our goal. And it's not just some arbitrary goal, it's what it takes to keep all of this going. So May is in jeopardy right now. So if we can get 35 folks to do $10 a piece tonight and tomorrow night, we're in under the wire and everything is beautiful. So there's that. Apart from that, however, and you know how to do this, right? The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, as is the snail mail address. So just help where you can, as you can. Because the nice thing is, for everyone who contributes to this program, we don't send out coffee mugs or T-shirts. Someday maybe we'll be wealthy enough to do that, or bumper stickers. But what you do know when you contribute to the Horn is that you're making it possible for us to continue as we have from the very beginning, thus that anybody who wants the program can get it. This isn't some right-wing approach to broadcasting where it's pay-to-play. There are a lot of people in this audience who cannot afford to contribute. There are a lot of people in this audience who contribute what they can as they can. That's the way it is with everybody who does contribute. But this way, all the podcasts are no charge. All the archives are there whenever you want them, as is the live show and the live stream. So just take that into consideration, that you are helping an entire community of people similarly committed as you are to progressive liberal media and to access to it at will. And that's just, that's just what it takes to get us from one month to the next. So that's out of the way. We all squared up on, on the schedule. And the only reason I make such a big deal out of it is that it's important that we get May taken care of, because June is probably going to be nightmarish. Okay? Because the bills don't change even if I'm not behind the microphone for a few days. Right? So it is Memorial Day 2011. Looking in the chat room, I see that Jug of Punch went to his town's parade. That's nice. We went up and visited some graves, not the least of whom is my uncle, whom I never knew, who did not come home from Europe in the Second World War. We have his flag, we have his Purple Heart, his certificate, and the notice of his untimely death, all signed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was in the fall of 1944. Of course, the origins of what is now called Memorial Day, you know, it only became a federal holiday in 1967. But its origins lie in the South and in something that was then called Decoration Day. As best as we can tell, the first Decoration Day was celebrated in Charleston, South Carolina in 1865. Freedmen. Free men who had formerly been enslaved, enslaved Africans joined together at the Washington Racecourse in Charleston, South Carolina, a place that had been formerly a Confederate prison camp. It was also a pit grave for Union soldiers who died in Confederate captivity. And those freedmen gathered in 1865 on May the 1st. And they had sermons, and they sang, they had a picnic on the grounds, and they remembered those Union soldiers who had died for their freedom. It expanded through the South after that, of course, in a sort of, as the South is wont to do, in a reactionary fashion, with the white folks deciding that Confederate veterans needed remembering too. And it was known as Decoration Day. The idea of Decoration Day gained a great deal more prominence in the years following the Second World War and the harrowing losses that the United States, well, had taken in that conflict. Harrowing in our own terms and without regard to the millions lost, say, by the Soviets, and without regard to the losses of the French or the English. But harrowing enough. And finally, as noted in 1967, Lyndon Johnson signed the law that created it as a national holiday. That's when Memorial Day became the official federal holiday. The following year, Monday holidays were created with the Uniform Holidays Bill. But it is a special time, a time of remembrance and a time of reverence. That hopefully stirs us all to a greater sense of dedication and purpose. Along the lines of what Lincoln said in that those ever so brief remarks that he said, the world would not long remember. He said, let us be, what, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. He also said, it is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. And it is that noble sacrifice that we remember. And remember we have. For my part today, well, it's end of the month, and no, I didn't put anything on the smoker. Didn't do any barbecuing at all. Didn't go to the pool. It was the first three back-to-back decent days we've had longer than I can recall. And I mowed grass. And I felt really good about mowing grass. Because it was sweaty and hot. And I thought about my father down in the boiler room of an aircraft carrier in the South Pacific. Hot, sweaty. And I thought about the generations that have been on this ground, who worked it in the same heat and sweated 10 times as hard. And in a way, it was my own little form of reverence for the ones who didn't come back. I had a great uncle who didn't come back. An uncle and a great uncle. They were both roughly the same age. One, my father's brother, did not come back from the south of France. He was part of a diversionary movement. Another one of Churchill's bright ideas. And he died, interestingly enough. I've told this story before, but it bears repeating. He died from a shrapnel wound to his knee. His knee. No, it didn't sever an artery and cause him to bleed to death. He died because that newfangled penicillin that was saving so many lives in the other European theater was almost entirely dedicated to that theater of conflict. So when infection set in my uncle's leg after the shrapnel wound, infection did the job that it has done on so many countless thousands, if not millions, of wounded soldiers through the course of time. In the Civil War, whose bloodshed, horror, and butchery we first contemplated something like a Memorial Day or a Decoration Day. The single greatest killer of the soldiery were not cannon shells nor mini balls. It's infection. War is a filthy, dirty thing on so many levels. And so it was that because none of the penicillin was available for Churchill's faint in the south of France, my uncle sickened, died, and came home in a box. The other one, my great uncle, would be dead a couple of months later, killed in the Siege of Bastogne, the Bulge, the Battle of the Bulge. He and my mother were very, very close. They were roughly the same age. He was the baby of the family. My grandmother's brother. He was a cook. He was an army cook. But he stopped being an army cook during the Siege of Bastogne and became a rifleman. But these are just little stories that are mine. Most every one of you, virtually any in any country in which you're listening, have something similar. And on Memorial Day, I think we are called to remember not only the heroic sacrifices, but the ultimate The ultimate futility and waste that is war. Among other things, I reflected as I stood there, shoving that lawnmower around. You ever tried to mow an entire acre of grass with a push mower? It's a blast. As I stood there shoving that mower around, I couldn't help thinking about some of the things that my dad said toward the end of his life as he watched the George W. Bush administration unfold into its second term. My father badly wanted to live to see George W. Bush exit the White House. He did not get that wish. But my father also had a very refined sense for spotting fascism when he saw it. And he told me repeatedly in those last years of his life, he told me repeatedly that what he saw stalking America was fascism. And it was, and it still is. And that's what I mean when I say the futility of war. There is virtually no way that Adolf Hitler or the Japanese, or Adolf Hitler and the Japanese in combination, could ever have imposed their will on the United States. But we, being the good and decent people that we were then, and largely are not now, would not sit idly by and watch a bully try to take over the majority of the globe. And so we finally entered the Second World War. And we defeated, or thought we had, what was referred to in the writings of the times as global fascism. Because the imperial regime of Japan was fascist. Germany was fascist. Italy was fascist. And they were the concrete threats to world civilization. And we eradicated world socialism, globe socialism. See, I've still got the thing in my head with the upper respiratory. It made the grass cutting a lot of fun, too, heaving and gasping. No, we eradicated global fascism. With one notable exception. We eradicated global fascism everywhere but at home. Because back at home, the Republican Party still existed. Back at home, the same fascists who had been supporters and admirers of Mr. Hitler and Mussolini, most notably of Mussolini, the father of a young man who grew up in New York City, the father being the head of the Mussolini organization, the pro-Mussolini organization in the United States, Mr. Scalia, would raise a son who, a septuagenarian now, sits on the bench of the highest court in the United States and does everything within his power to continue his father's dream of advancing the global fascist agenda. And I'd have to say that Papa would be pretty proud, because Antonin Fat Tony Scalia is fascist through and through. Don't think for a minute that the absence of the Sam Brown belt or the spiffy uniform makes him any less one. There are overtones of Christo-fascism, blatant ones, in Sarah Palin, in Michelle Bachmann, God knows in Newt Gingrich, in the body of the entire teabag nation, hooting about the Constitution at the same time that they do everything in their power to destroy it. And so it was that it brought tears to my eyes when, as a 80-year-old man, my father would ask me, is this what my brother and so many of my friends died for? Is this what we fought to preserve? When he looked at the depredations and the excesses of the Bush administration. And of course it wasn't. They came home from the war convinced that they could do anything. And for a time they did. And then they turned it over to a subsequent generation who was told by a resurgent Republican Party that no, by God, they could not do anything, that we could barely do anything at all. And so we find ourselves in the year 2011. And I think we are called. I think we are called to reflect upon what kind of nation we wish to build and pass on to the next generation. If you're a regular listener of this program, and if you're a listener of this program, odds are you're a regular. This is a program that is not something you just jump into one night and come back a few weeks later. It has a sort of serial quality to it. But you'll note that we've had some fairly grim conversations about empire and stepping back from empire and getting away from empire and getting back to the vision of those great people who went before us. Well, the other side, the fascists, they have their visions as well. There is a reason. And Susie Madrak over at Crooks and Liars picked up on it. There is a reason that Godzilla from Wasilla uses things like restoration in her bus tour, which she imposed upon the Rolling Thunder group so as to demean and dishonor the Memorial Day call for awareness of those who still remain missing in action and who were POWs. I got an email of a post from Democratic Underground today from our buddy Dennis down in Kentucky, my lawn mowing buddy. He listens to the podcast while he cuts grass. Someone by the handle 11 Bravo over at Democratic Underground posted the following. Okay, Sarah, now it's effing personal. For some time now, you've been an amusing, albeit mostly incoherent, annoyance. But you crossed a line today. With that high-cut helmet carefully designed to allow your professionally coiffed hair to flow freely, you've tried to hijack a moment that you can't even begin to understand. You decided that an event, talking about the Rolling Thunder gathering, that an event that has for years been intended to call attention to our POW MIAs would make a really cool photo op, as well as a great kickoff for your next get-rich-quick scheme. Well, Sarah, you picked my war this time. I had several buddies, two of whom died within a couple of meters of me, and you zoomed right past their names on the wall today, winking and smiling all the way. You weren't invited. You weren't welcome. But when has that ever stopped you? Did you make a few extra bucks for your pack? If so, I hope that helps you sleep tonight. Because you see, Sarah, my buddies have been sleeping for 40 years. And if they knew that a two-bit grifter like you would one day be making money off of their sacrifice, they might not be resting as easily as I hope they are tonight. I'm a Christian, Sarah, and I don't say this lightly. God damn you, Sarah Palin. Indeed. Indeed. And so, as it is Memorial Day, I think it fitting that we sort of look at a larger picture of where we, of where all those sons and daughters. It wasn't only boys that died in Vietnam, nor only boys in Korea, nor only boys in the Second World War. Where those sons and daughters came from. And I will submit to you that they came, even as far up as the Vietnam conflict, from a very, very different America from than the America in which we now live. And with that in mind, and I know you're going to push back at me for this, because I get grief every time I run a clip from this jiggling, drug-addicted gas bag. I want you to listen to something. And I don't just play this to have, oh, let's have a little audio in the program. No. And I don't play it to annoy you. Play it to make a point. And I think you'll understand the point. I know you will understand the point once we're done. You see, this is a clip. Caroli over at Crooks and Liars found it, pulled it. And it's a clip of Flush Flimball, the oxymoron. And it's not about Memorial Day. And it's not technically about veterans. But there is a tie-in here that I think is unmistakable and undeniable. If I could just get the damn thing to load. It loaded earlier. This is an example of having absolute, and I guess this is what happens when you make $50 million a year and you live in a walled-off fortress in Florida and have to send your maid out for boxes upon boxes of illicit street drugs. I guess you get a little bit divorced from reality, and sometimes, no, in his case, all the time, you just say some batshit crazy stuff. I guess it just can't be helped. You may be in luck. You may not actually have to hear this, vile pig's actual voice. It was one of those rare instances where he actually takes a call from a listener. And he said, If you believe the majority of stories we get about the elderly in this country, because you see they're talking about the Republican plan to kick Granny into the gutter. If you believe the majority of stories we get about the elderly in this country, that they are, for the most part, just a couple of steps away from poverty. And his caller says, hi, no, I don't believe that. And I hate to say this, but if they are a step away from poverty, that is their responsibility because they did not save for their future. It is not my responsibility that you spent all of your money and did not save for your future. Okay, so that's the typical right-wing talking point. Personal responsibility for everybody but them. But it's what happens a little bit further into the exchange that grabbed me. I'm talking about America's elderly population, and this is something that Flush has babbled on and on and on about, nearly ad nauseam. For years, he takes great joy in it. He likes to talk about kids adults having to move back into their parents' home because they live in an America where they themselves cannot make it anymore. Or young people, and he always says, offers it as proof of an overly indulgent society, that somehow children should be left out on the streets to sink or swim, and that somehow builds character. You know, the whole time that Flemball was out running around learning to be a DJ in places like Pittsburgh, or when he was selling hot dogs for the Kansas City Royals and went out to Sacramento, he was subsidized by his parents the entire time because he comes from a family of significant wealth in southeast Missouri, a town called Cape Girardeau. His grandfather was some sort of lawyer or a judge. He's got a cousin who's on the federal bench. He got into radio because daddy owned a radio station. So we have this gem from Flush Flemball. Young people are moving back in with them. They're moms and dads. And some of these people moving back in are 35 and 40. How old are their moms and dads? 60 and 70, try. But they're 60 and 70, and if they can afford their worthless offspring moving back in with them, just how poverty-stricken are they? I'm almost glad I don't have the clip. Because that's pretty sickening all by its lonesome self. Now, what's the hookup here? Well, the connection is that is the understanding that I think you have, and that I have. Oh, by the way, David in Tennessee wondering, anybody seen the latest Mrs. Flemball lately? Well, no, neither has anyone else. Maybe she's in a pit in the basement eating a high-carb diet designed to help her grow her skin large enough to fit Flush once it's off her. It puts the lotion on its skin, and then it rubs the lotion in. I can make your life a living hell. You're not even on a milk carton, honey. It puts the lotion on its skin. Yeah. But there's a connection here. There really is. Because, as noted, the idea of a Decoration Day or a Day of Remembrance or a Memorial Day was born in the ashes of the conflagration of the Civil War. And the people who fought that war came from America that was still largely agrarian and rural. Sure, some from the cities, but the population of this nation was still largely agrarian and rural. And so, by force of necessity, the people who fought it had to have come from rural backgrounds. Such was, of course, also the case with the Spanish-American War and the First World War and the Second World War. And that's where things begin to change. Because all of those families that sent all of those sons and some of those daughters into those meat grinders came from families where the same house frequently included a grandmother and grandfather, a mother and a father, and the latest generation who would get married and move on to the same land. We have a word for that structure. It is called an extended family. And since World War II, that rural population has been sent on a wild goose chase toward some vague definition of prosperity, and that extended family has been torn all asunder. It's still possible, I may be in boroughs of big cities, but my experience is in the South, to go places and hear names that have been names in that community one way or another for 200 years. Well, you know, them who's and wazzles is all like that. They can't help it. We've chuckled about that on the show from time to time. Back, for instance, when Kate was being culturally immersed in the South. Bless his heart, he can't help it. Just like his daddy. You know, that kind of thing. But those little bits of homespun folk wisdom came about because the great-grandfather, the grandfather, the father, and the son were all there to be observed within the passing of the generations, such that it was subject to transgenerational observation and wisdom. A 100 years ago, no one would have been shocked, as Flush Flemball is apparently shocked, no one would have been shocked for a 30 or 40 year old son to be living in the same house with a 70 or 80 year old parent. It would have been shocking had they not been. Because for that rural population to have not attended to the needs of its aging patriarchs and matriarchs would have amounted to a wholesale abandonment and a total rejection of the idea of that extended family upon which this nation was built. And like I said, it shows you how thoroughly divorced Flush Flemball is from reality. And not just reality, from any knowledge of history. It was the big old family farmhouse in Kansas and in Iowa. And extended family houses in Appalachia and Mississippi. Some fine, some built with loving care, and some scrabbled together as best they could be made. But it was a culture that rejected the idea that old people were simply goods to be warehoused for profit by nursing home corporations. There were certainly problems attendant on that system. But I often wonder if the benefits outweighed the difficulties. Because you raised a family to work the farm, to allow the next generation to raise a family to work the farm. And the system worked. Now, let me give credit where credit is due. These are ideas that have long run around in my head, but they are absolutely elaborated upon to best effect by my good friend, now departed, Joe Bagent. It's in his book, Rainbow Pie, which I heartily commend to all of you. I think we've got an Amazon portal somewhere on the website. If you want to order it, go through our portal and we'll get, you know, 0.2% of one penny. But it's in Rainbow Pie that he lays this out in a meticulous fashion so that his thesis that America was dismantled wholesale becomes inescapable. And while the right wing and its religion industry arm likes to constantly prate on about modern problems being the function of, we've gotten away from God, need to turn back to Jebus, and make a tidy fortune on making that argument, the fact of the matter is, we have turned our back on family. And that is why we experience the cognitive dissonance that we do. That is why we experience the sense of gravity being gone and just floating. That's why. It's why those farm kids who came off the farm turned out to be such damn good soldiers and sailors. Jesus, I think it was both Dwight Eisenhower and Bull Halsey came from Kansas. Eisenhower went on, of course, to be general of the army, 5 stars, and president of the United States. Maybe it was Pennsylvania. No, I think it was Kansas. And that's natural. But an admiral from Kansas? Really? Not the New England shore, not the Gulf Coast, not the Pacific. Kansas? But this was a nation that once had the idea that it could make anything of anyone. And so a boy might go off to Annapolis, Maryland, from a place like Kansas, and climb through the ranks, and wind up in charge of the on-the-sea effort to beat back the Empire of Japan. That was an America that is gone now, and it is gone to our detriment. I know so many people of my generation and the generation ahead of me who say, I will not go in a nursing home. Who say, I got a little blue steel friend that'll take care of me before I wallow in a puddle of my own filth. There are a lot of sad places in America, but a nursing home is probably the saddest. Because America's nursing home culture is a confession that American culture itself is no longer connected from one generation to the next. That we reach the end of a commercial usefulness and then are cast aside with no regard for the wisdom that may yet remain. And once you're in that little room, in that little bed, staring at those four walls, your mind goes in a real hurry. And such institutions were very rare once upon a time. You went into a care facility because you were beyond the scientific ability of your family to give care, not because you had reached the limits of your usefulness. Neither my mother nor my father died in any such facility. Because, broke-ass poor as we are, we have hung on and gritted our teeth and clenched our fingers to the last little bit of anything to try to retain that much of family culture. And there are lots more, but the number shrinks. And so I was especially disgusted to hear Rush offer up that kind of abject, miserable hate.
The majority of stories we get about the elderly in this country, that they are, for the most part, just a couple steps away from poverty.
You know what? No, I don't believe that. And I hate to say this, but if they are a step away from poverty, that is their responsibility because they did not save for their future. It is not my responsibility that you spent all of your money and did not save for your future.
You know, the reason I ask is because, and I can't find it. I left it on the desk. It was from an earlier program. I didn't get to it. I left it here in the stack. But we had a temporary engineer here who went on a Betty Crocker kick and threw everything in here in the trash. It was a story. He's a nice guy. Not a Dale. He was just trying to do the right thing. But it was a story that took aim at this myth that the elderly are all a bunch of poverty-stricken people. Now, don't look at me. I'm just teasing him there. Dale's a great guy. But he did throw away my show prep. What am I supposed to do?
What are you supposed to do, Rush?
What do you mean you didn't know it? You're the one that told him the procedure's here.
What are you supposed to do, Rush? I remember Michael Richards. Remember Kramer from Seinfeld? In the early days of his career as some sort of a pill head on an ABC comedy series, and his signature line was, "Take a pill! Take a pill, Rush! What are you supposed to do?" You see, to be a ditto monkey, to be one of the mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, house-helmet-wearing, knee-padded and elbow-padded, Velcro-shoed, oatmeal-dribbling faithful who, maybe a million of them or so around the country, who listen to this drug-addled gas bag every day, is to separate yourself from reality and from intelligence and from any sort of thought process. Because before, the Social Security was not just some dream of Huey Long that was then co-opted by FDR. Oh, no. It wasn't as if the Bolsheviks had taken over and decided, yeah, you know what, let's give Granny and Granddad a little something-something just to keep them voting. America had a grinding elderly poverty problem. And that's part of the reason that existed, that extended family I'm talking about continued to exist. If you lost, if at the age of 60 or 70 or 80, if you lost a son, a daughter, you often lost a home. And at that age, we're in the streets awaiting a grim and miserable death. Those stories are legion. Add in the Great Depression, and it becomes a manifest horror and a blight upon the name of this nation. And so Social Security was conceived as a way of trying to make sure that our aging population didn't die in the streets and stack up like decaying cordwood. Not that Flush Flimball knows anything about that.
Anyway, I don't need the story. I can recount it from under. The story was about, by the way, where is it written that every old person is on the brink of destruction economically? And I thought it was a fascinating story. Everybody does think, or a lot of people think, that the elderly, they're all in poverty or just a step or two away from it.
That's what I love, those professional radio snorts into the golden EIB microphone. That's what you get $50 million a year for.
But who is it that young people are moving back in with? Their moms and dads. And some of these people moving back in are 35 and 40. How old are their moms and dads? 60 and 70 try. So they're 60 and 70, and if they can afford their worthless offspring moving back in with them, just how poverty-stricken are they? So this story tried to...
It's not even funny. It's not even... It's too easy. Sometimes these 30 and 40-year-olds move back in with their parents because that way maybe they, pooling everything they have, can then survive. You see, wage stagnation doesn't exist in Flush Flimball's world where he gets a few million dollars raise every year. This doesn't exist. You don't exist. I don't exist. We don't exist. A single woman living by herself, aged 70, who gets $27 worth of food stamps a month, doesn't exist. And that America doesn't exist that sent sons and daughters into horrible conflict. The only thing that exists in Flush Flimball's and his followers and the Repiglicans and the teabaggers, the only thing that exists is their sense, not of manifest destiny, but of manifest privilege. Because they are a privileged class who are entitled, here's that word, to leech off the rest of us, even if it means they wind up sucking the marrow from our very bones and the bones of our grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers. That's all. We are capitalized, corporatized, profitized, and monetized. Just as that entire extended rural family structure was broken into a million pieces in support of and pursuit of a consumer model to sustain an unsustainable culture following the end of the Second World War.
Well, that myth up, that every elderly person in this country is bankrupt or soon to be, and it's...
See, this is such a logical fail. No one is asserting that every elderly person is in dire straits. There are some who are quite well off. They were quite well off during their working lives as well. And that obligation to save for one's future, how do the right-wingers answer for those who saved and then got robbed by Flush's pals on Wall Street? How does he answer for the grandmother who was conned into a refi on her home and lost it when the bubble burst? Well, the simple answer is he doesn't account for it because they don't exist. America doesn't exist. American history doesn't exist. The culture that brought us to where we are doesn't exist. The only thing that exists for these godless, heathen, right-wing bastards is their own relentless avarice and their sucking, grasping, grabbing need to consume everything before they finally breathe their last. And so on this day, we take time to remember not only those who fell in conflict, but the world from which they came. The Hispanic kid from the American Southwest who comes from an extended family of grannies and grandpas. What's the Spanish word for grandmother? Abuela. And was thrust into a jungle thousands of miles away and came home feet first. The black kid from the Deep South who grew up in the same kind of extended family but came home the same way. The white kid from the Midwest, same story. Different cadences, different rhythms, but the same story. And the same story in cities. One need not be rural to have an extended family. Not by any stretch of the imagination. As William just noted, pulling together is how my mom's generation survived the Great Depression. I suppose Sarah Palin would think that that was communism. But I can't talk about these things without remembering the context in which these things exist. The clay pot pulled out of the ground is not just a clay pot. It only becomes something greater when you understand the context from which that clay pot came. And that context begins to let you fill in the blank spaces and see mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters aunts, uncles, cousins. And it is in that relentless desire to make us forget all of it that some of the nastiest, most vulgar work of the right wing is done. Just my 2 cents worth. I could go much further, but enough. So we'll take a little break and come back to your phone calls. You know the number. It's Memorial Day. Let's do some remembering. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. An email comes in to bobkincaid@gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
What can you see from your window? I can't see anything from mine. Flags on the side of the highway and scripture on grocery store signs. Maybe 18 was too early. Maybe 30 or 40 is too. You get your chance to make with the man, or is set down his angels free. Mamas and grandmamas love you, 'cause that's all they know how to do. Never planned on the bombs in the sand, or sleeping in
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
And we do begin hour number two. A couple of updates for you. We're down to only needing... Well, we're down to needing 16 less in the 5250 for this evening. That would be 19. I can't do math on the fly, especially not with a head cold. 19. And thanks to those who have made that a reality. Many thanks. A couple of emails before we do go back to the phones. Some thoughts from David in Tennessee. First of all, my psychotic sainted mother never, ever called this day by any save for Decoration Day. She'd stop speaking in a conversation before using that new name. Whether stemming from her War Between the States fixated grandmother or the stories from her sweetheart of an uncle that was gassed in the war to end all wars, mother had no truck with that new name. Also noting, does David, if working class America gave the oxymorons jab even the most cursory of evaluation, what he said about kids moving back in their parents' homes, they would take his voice off their radio boxes en masse. They'd realize how mean and ignorant those comments really are. And see, this is one of those things that didn't get a big deal made out of it, except for Caroli over at Crooks and Liars and, of course, Media Matters, who grabbed the clip. But it is every bit as filthy, every bit as nasty, every bit as hateful as anything he's ever said, including, I hope he fails. And Darlene simply offering, Flush is such a sick, toxic MF-er. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Then this from Kate up in the... Up on the High Plains, I guess. Would you call it? Yeah, Montana. High Plains. High Mountains. Montana, one way or the other. Bob, I don't ever listen to what others are saying on AM and how the attitudes are shifting. However, your monologue made me think of all my passengers. I'm volunteering for the Disabled Vets of America out of the VA here in Helena. I'm the long-haul driver for what we call the High Line. Those little towns along Jim Hill's Transcontinental Railroad are full of vets who can't afford the gas to drive 200 miles to a doctor appointment. By the way, I volunteered to attend to that area because my home dirt bell started ringing this year. Spent the first 24 years of my life up there and feel like my life has come full circle. Back to the subject at hand. I'm reviewing all my passengers in my mind. Some are living with their aging parents to be caregivers. Some have come back to Montana to work the family farm. Some have come home to the res to be close to their extended families and to help raise the grandkids. The DAV program is going a long way to see to it that these vets can remain at home and not have to go to the old folks' homes. The regional VA here is far and away above all the VA programs that are around the country. This isn't what I would call disaster relief, as I have such a passion for. Rather, it's like disaster prevention. 2 weeks ago, I had 3 500-mile days. I have a new little 6-passenger van, a gas car, and a cell phone, and no boss. I am blessed that I can come home and still be on the road. Keeping it between the ditches on the Front Range. That's where she is, Kate, on the Front Range in Montana. So we go now to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, so yeah, you're on air, huh? No barbecue?
No. No barbecue. A friend of ours' daughter graduated from high school last Friday night, and there was a little picnic on Saturday out at the lake, and we went to that and let that stand for, yeah, the big to-do.
I mean, I hear that Russia's ratings are, like, you know, falling through the floor.
Yeah, lower and lower and lower. But that doesn't stop him, Sander, from, 40, 50, 60 minutes. The entire country listens to me every week.
Yeah, no, I know. He is so repulsive. It's incredible what he's talking. I mean, and the fact that people listen to that rich fuck, I mean, he's just, he has no credibility. What is he talking about?
Well, that's the sad thing, though, Sandra. There, as you heard, he had a caller who advanced the argument for him. That, by God, it's the fault of these no-good, layabout, lazy, slug old people that they didn't save for their retirements.
Well, no, it's incredible. It's just these people are so brainwashed. They have no way of understanding any kind of connection at all. I mean, this is what you're getting back to get the Republican people sort of say, wait a minute, I don't want to be left trying to take care of my aging parents with health care in this country.
No. And it's young people too. The Brandon's in the chat room, and I saw him post a little bit ago. He said, "I lost 33% of my 401k. Who's going to go to jail for that? Nobody."
Hey, no, I mean, it's just, the thing is that I mean, forgive me for saying this. Now that they're not just taking away money from Negroes or fee money from Negroes, all of a sudden the issue. I mean, that's the worst.
Sandra, I hate to say it, but you're breaking up rather badly, and it's not you, it's me. Apparently, we've got a new brace of problems here. I'm really excited about them. But I got the vast majority of what you said, and, what is it part of the problem that, Medicare pays for nursing home care, so that's why it happens? Or is it the fact that people who are, you don't have time to take care of mom or dad or grandma and grandpa because nobody can stay in the home.
Can you hear better now?
It's pretty marginal.
Oh.
Snake bit again.
I'll call back, see if it's better.
Okay, and I'm going to check on some things, too. I may have to fire up a little bit of music just to get things squared away.
You might try another caller. See if
it looks like I'm having some ugly little bandwidth issues again.
Okay, I'll come back and have it. So.
Okay, stand by. Or we'll talk in a minute.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. This drives me nuts. Get started on a. No, that's impossible. Okay, so I wasn't sure if I could get away with it in terms of time. Let me do something here, though. It's only 3 minutes long, but I need to get a call into CityNet and get them on this right away. Stand by, we'll come right back. But I had a special request for this from Jim, just sort of in honor of all the ordinary folks who have done such extraordinary things in horrible circumstances. Such that we have a day for remembering. So this is for you, Jim.
Thank you.
Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, and I'm pleased to announce that we have problem solved. So, Sandra, if you're still listening and not completely frustrated, you know, that's twice you've been snake bit, and I apologize for that. But it was my fault and not yours. Ring back in. I want to complete the conversation. Meanwhile, hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Yes.
Is it Andy?
Yeah, hey, Andy, what's up?
Not much. Can you hear me okay?
I got you just fine. No breakup at all.
Oh, good. Because I happen to be on a cell phone.
No, it's amazing how quickly you can get stuff fixed course of a small piece of music. Andy, go ahead.
That's good. I just said that was a nice monologue you did.
Well, thank you.
At the beginning.
I heard that clip from the Oxymoron back toward the end of last week, and since it was Memorial Day coming up, it made some little bulb go off in my head, and it was sort of unescapable.
Well, I liked more so the sacrifices you talked about with your relatives, and also the comment about how we did a nice job in Europe through the Marshall Plan, getting rid of fascism, and that was by design that we actually organized the industrial base of Europe so that fascism would not be able to rise again. But as you said, it did not take place here, and we're feeling the effects of that right now. I don't think there's any question about that.
Well, I'm sure that there are some, oh, what do we call them, Andy? Moderates, centrists, middle of the roaders, you know, who call themselves Democrats, who is like, oh, they're, you know, and because they recoil from you if you say that word, or if you suggest in any way that America is anything except dripping in the milk of human kindness. But Andy, you can't live in the real world and feel that way, can you?
No, not at all. And you're right, there's a blackout on that word. I know if you wrote anything on the Huffington Post, that word could never show up in anything you wrote.
And doesn't that just tell you a boatload?
Right. Well, that's where that organization was definitely coming from. You weren't going to get the full truth there, because the capitalists would not hear. They do not want to hear that word. And there were some liberal talk show hosts that also you can just not use that word.
You're kidding. I mean, not asking you to tell tales out of school or anything, but who won't let you use that word?
Well, more so the word Nazi than fascist, but I kind of put them together.
Well, yeah, because, well, one is just a branding of the other.
Correct.
You know, fascist being the mother policy. You know, we're so inept at remembering history, especially, you know, we're bad at our own history, let alone anybody else's. You know, fascism had been marching around Italy from almost the very end of the First World War.
Right, the early 1920s.
Yeah.
Right after World War One. Exactly right. In the 1920s, it really got rocking and rolling.
And it should be remembered that there really were a lot of people in this country who just, well, you know, because, I mean, that phrase rose up, you know, Mussolini made the trains run on time.
No question, there were a lot of goose steppers here in the United States.
And I don't think they ever really went away.
Correct, particularly up around upstate New York, which that one district you just heard that Democrat won, places like that Buffalo area was very, very right-wing and very fascist, and also the Cincinnati area has always known as being very, very strongly German fascist thinking area.
And you know, the Ford family, Henry Ford's what was his newspaper's name? The Dearborn Daily or whatever it was that was, I mean, you know, that Henry Ford, and he controlled the editorial content, he reprinted the protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Well, he too had done a lot, I believe, with Germany as well, and the Ford connection in Germany with, you know, manufacturing plants and so forth. And there were connections there with the hierarchy, in the Nazi hierarchy, with Henry Ford. No question, he had that bent. Had that mind bent.
And, you know, who else did business with the Germans, you know, besides the obvious answer, the Bush family? Ford was in on it. IBM?
IBM, right. Corporate America, fascism, totalitarianism, authoritarianism works great for the corporate environment. All they want is to be able to move product and to do commerce. The easiest way to do that is in an authoritarian, when the trains run on time, just like you said. That's all they want. Democracy and rights for the citizens and rights for the purchasers of products and rights for the environment, that doesn't work very well for the strict capitalist. That doesn't work. That just hampers commerce. Can't have that.
Right. You know, I don't know if you heard Friday's show, but Sandra introduced a new phrase into the conversation that has just been bouncing around my tiny little otherwise empty head like a ping pong ball since, and that is this slight barrier to trade phrase that now within the purview of like the WTO, the plea of slight barrier to trade is enough to do things like, as Sandra mentioned, keep you keep Starkist from being able to put Dolphin Safe on its labels. Can't do that. That's a slight barrier to trade.
Right. These free trade deals in the WTO completely takes away our sovereignty as a country to be able to do what we want to do. It is sad. I heard a phrase today I thought was great. Instead of saying NAFTA, you should just say SHAFTA.
Right.
That's definitely what it is.
Yeah, because there's NAFTA and SHAFTA and CAFTA and geez, you know, and I mean, there's a Colombian version and a Korean version and
Korean version, right? It just is totally to screw the working man.
And they're all the same thing,
right?
You know,
definitely in favor of the Hamilton plan. Let's bring that back, man. Let's bring back the tariff system.
But, you know, one of the things that I wondered about, as Sandra mentioned that last week, is could we even do something like a tariff now within the purview of, I mean, we'd have to wholesale get rid of these things, right?
Absolutely. Probably the answer is no. You cannot do it under the current WTO framework because they've taken away too much of our sovereignty. Got to get out of the WTO. Of course, that's why they had the battle in Seattle and all the demonstrations that they have against the G8 and the summits and the WTO in Italy and in Seattle and in Canada, because this is just world hegemony of the capitalists over the working people. I believe the WTO is just this great umbrella that's the great equalizer for the corporation and just pummels working people across a number of countries, everybody that's in it. The working people takes the hit. It just, you know, it's putting us on the lowest common denominator.
Why not just call all these things global Milton Friedman acts?
No, absolutely, that is what it is.
Because the summer, they may be written in different languages and they may have different nuances, Andy. But the end result is always, no matter where it happens, to drive wages down. You know, in many instances here in the United States, eliminate wages because you eliminate jobs.
Wages, benefits, right? Wages, benefits, the two-tier pay structures. I see these articles. There's an article in the New York Times today about the comeback of Detroit. And the comeback of Detroit is totally being done on the backs of the working people, especially the second-tier workers, the newer workers that come. They don't nearly have the benefits or the pay structure that the workers who remain there have.
And that's, you know, that's no accident. That is wholly by design, Andy.
Absolutely. And you have this guy, Alan Mulally, coming over from Boeing, who's the big savior of Ford. Here, this guy, I read in the paper a couple of months ago where he got him and Ford, the Ford heir that's on the board, I think he's vice chairman or something like that, Alan Mulally is chairman. They both got $100 million bonus for bringing Ford. $100 million, and Mulally gets like $60 million of that, and the Ford heir gets like $40 million. Gosh, how disgraceful! And here, the sacrifice that the workers made, and these guys are getting those kind of bonuses. That is just. Oh, it's just incredible. It's kind of mind-boggling. You can get a $60 million.
And the question, you know, is it even necessarily tied to performance or superior performance or keeping the company out of the ditch? You know, just any of them would be fine.
Well, how brain-dead can you be? It was a simple solution. You stop making the big gas cars. You stop making big trucks. You stop making SUVs, and you make the smaller vehicles. It was pretty simple. Or you make hybrids like the Toyota Prius, which was eating their lunch. I mean, it's pretty simple to see you had to go to the small car model. This isn't rocket science, is it? I mean, really. And they were saying, okay, well, now it used to be like 10 years ago, 1 out of 8 cars sold by Detroit were the compact. Now it's 1 out of 4. Well, is this, again, is this rocket science? Seeing what's happened to the price of gasoline, that you had to make small cars, you had to get more on the European model of the car sizes and the miles per gallon. Jesus, this isn't rocket science to give these two guys $100 million for support. Unbelievable to me.
Well, you would think that it's not.
Yeah.
But they always fell back on some really old, tiresome the talking points, Andy, along the lines of, I don't know, the American people don't want to drive in small cars. But,
sure.
You know, I mean, that was their excuse for continuing to build the Ford... the Ford Gargantua and the Chevy.
Explorer or something like that.
Yeah.
Explorers, the Tahoes, Bourbons. But, you know, they advertise and they push those on the American public at infinitum. I mean, their ad budgets are tremendous, and you don't do that stuff on work unless it works. Edward Bernays and the whole Madison Avenue thing, you don't advertise the way GM, Ford, and Chrysler advertise, unless it works. You wouldn't do it if it didn't work. And they just propaganda, and they push that. They push those big gas cars. I turned around and they started pushing the compact cars. You get the volumes out of that, if they did that. But you don't want to do that because they don't have the margin.
Right. And that's the thing. You know, the reason that every other vehicle on the road for 10, 15 years with some godforsaken SUV is because they had perfected a profit model on it, not a design model, certainly
Absolutely.
Not a fuel efficiency model. They could build them fast. Everything was standardized and kick them out the door. And I'm not being some sort of elitist snob about this. I live in a place where having a four-wheel drive vehicle is actually arguably a necessity. Because
you don't clean the roads there, and you have pretty tough.
Well, and even in the best of weather, you can run out of hard pavement in a real hurry.
Right.
So right. You know, there's a place for them, but you know, if you live in a place where the pavement never ends, and you've got something approaching a responsible snow clearing system. The hell do you need it for?
Right.
And I don't mean you, but I mean, you know, America. But again, there's a culture around those things, like there's a culture around guns. You know, if you own a pickup truck and it ain't four wheel drive, you know the boys down to the bowling alley are gonna give you hell driving that sissy truck. Ain't got four wheel drive. How you ever gonna go off road? You know, Bubba, when's the last time you went off-road, really? Because I didn't have to go off-road to get to the bowling alley.
Right. Hey, a few items I wanted to bring up. I was listening to one of your older shows, and you did a big piece on Roger Rotnam. You can say it much better than I can.
Oh, yes.
You mentioned in there about him maybe getting banned from the industry. I think that's a very likely outcome. Not that it means anything, though, because he's already had his fun by earning $1 billion. But that's what happened to Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken during the 80s. They got banned from the industry. They've still been kept out of it, even though Milken always tries to come back. He's been trying to come back for years, but I believe...
Yeah, Milken's kind of Wall Street's answer to Pete Rose. Going to keep on trying to get into the hall.
Absolutely. But he's a small fry, too, in the big scheme of things. I mean, getting something like Roger Utnum might stop some of the insider trading by the hedge funds, but the real structural damage that is done by Wall Street, by the Timmy Geithners and the Larry Summers and the Alan Greenspans and the Lloyd Blank Fines and people like that, they're not paying the price that should be paid. They're the people that should be going down in some kind of big fraud, or S&P, or Moody's, and all the fraud. There should be some tremendous fraud cases with some of these CEOs just going down. That would really...
Right, and that goes back
not
to the...
somebody like this.
That goes back to the frustration of, you know, seeing news stories come out, for instance, about the impending indictment of John Edwards, which the for-profit media will leap on, and we will have to live through the lurid and sorry recounting of every moment of that business.
Again.
But they don't have the brains to explain, you know, the fact that we got robbed blind,
right.
You know, by the Wall Street crowd.
Right. Let's see somebody like Jamie Dimon or Lewis of... B of A. Some of these big CEO guys, man, they're the guys that should be paying the price. That's the shame. You know something, too, I wanted to bring up? The situation with this Marilyn Atwell Baker over at the FCC.
Yeah.
That she's going over to Comcast.
Right.
That's part of the well-chumped category, you guys like that. Well-chumped. Do you know who she is? Who she's the daughter of?
Oh yeah, that's
Marilyn Atwell Baker.
Yeah, the Republican operative Poppy Bush pal Baker Howard. No,
James Baker.
James
III,
Baker.
Right?
Yeah, not James Howard Baker.
Baker the third, right? What chief of staff to Pappy and Bush family friend, the consigliere of the Bush family, for God's sake. And Obama appointed her.
And Obama appointed her. See, I was waiting for that part.
He appointed her. You talked about fascists. If he isn't one of the number one fascists, her daddy, James Baker III, who put Bush Jr. in office, for God's sake, he was the guy running around Florida with his law firm just doing all the legal work to make sure that deal was sewed up. Jesus, you talk about fascist number one, and who put her on there but Obama? This is just such a... incestuous.
And see that's the thing, Andy. You know, I don't think that. I mean, I just think about what it is to be an ordinary human being. I don't think Barack Obama's walking around with a list of, you know, hey, I got to put James Baker's daughter on the FCC. No, there are people around him that are the wrong people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That come with their agenda and their idea of how you're going to maintain. Business as usual in what Jim refers to as the Forbidden City, and I think he's spot on with that. Because, you know, we're going to maintain the hall of exalted advisors, and I guess now you know that's an argument that there's some cross pollination. You know, remember Robert Gates didn't exactly come to the Obama administration with his democratic credentials on his chest.
No, that's absolutely correct. He had those Republican calling cards going along with him too. Something else I wanted to correct the record on. I think I told you a few weeks ago that in Egypt, when they had the demonstrations, that Mubarak and his gangsters killed 1,000.
Yeah.
Demonstrators. It was actually 850.
Okay.
I was off. It was actually 850. But better than the corporate media that was always saying, like, less than 500. But, you know, they're trying to bring him to trial now, Hosni Mubarak, for the 850 demonstrators that were gunned down or clubbed over there.
And I got no problem with that whatsoever. It might work in better terms to follow maybe the South African Truth and Reconciliation model. I'm fond of that model, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, we don't necessarily have to have blood running in the streets, but everybody has to get up and say, I did it with my little hatchet, in order to get the pass, so that everybody will then know it was him.
Right, there's got to be a mea culpa, right? And it just doesn't happen. Like with the torture thing here, that'd be something we should be doing. Especially some of the lower level guys that did it. I mean, they could definitely speak up and vouch for what actually happened.
And you know what? I would be okay with giving immunity of those lower level guys, because while I'm bothered that we would be sort of casting aside the notion that one cannot plead I was only following orders that we established at Nuremberg, if it led to a trail I would want to be in the room to hear Don Rumsfeld say, yes, we knew what we were doing, we meant to do it. It was all a big fraud. You're all a bunch of suckers. Yeah, I want to hear that. And it would be worth giving some immunities to some lower levels to create the trail that led to him.
Right, and if I didn't say so, I'd love to hear him give the mea culpa too on the Pat Tillman situation.
Oh God, yes.
That whole cover up, I think.
Now look Pat Tillman's mama in the eye.
Right. I think that was something else that came out of his office. The whole idea, it seems perfect, Rumsfeld. Perfect. Something else to push his war effort with somebody, you know, who died definitely under dubious circumstances, to say the least.
Well, you know, we have that. We have that.
Also caught up in that, of course. He was back in the Obama administration.
Yeah. We have that, you know, we have the Wall Memorial in Washington, D.C., and if we can ever manage to end these foolhardy wastes of flesh, blood, and treasure in the Middle East, I still say that the next memorial, and there will be one, needs to be in the shape of an oil pipeline, Andy, with the name of every single human being who was lost, whose lives were thrown away in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. Just one other thing, too. I sent you an email last week. I don't want to spend too much more time. Because Bill Clinton, in this deal at the Pete Peterson Group speech that he gave...
Hey, why do you show up at the Pete Peterson Group? Just saying.
Right.
But, right.
Right. When the speaker before you or after you is that clown from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan, for God's sakes. Call me! Bill says to Mr. Ryan.
Hey, Paul, call me. I want to talk to you, buddy.
But you see, this is the payback for Bill Clinton. You can only imagine how much he got paid to give that speech and to come out and say that we got to ratchet back Medicare and do something about Social Security. You know, to get in front of that group and to give the right-wing Democrats some cover, exactly. Give Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi, both Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi are on record as saying that we have to cut back on Medicare and Social Security, that we have to do something to shore them up, both of them, and they're supposed to be the leaders.
And see, this is where I lose all patience, Andy, because the way you shore up Medicare is by making everybody eligible for it.
Right, putting more money into it, right, and not taking it away, and taking away its insurance status. It should always be an insurance program, always something everybody's in it. Everybody's got some skin in the game, right? You do not want to make it so it's some kind of just welfare thing for a certain segment of the population. That's the way they get rid of it. Absolutely. Everybody's got to have skin in the game with that. And if everybody's putting into it, it'll be shored up in no time.
And that's the reason that the rich are allowed to collect Social Security.
Right. I have them have skin in the game. And I'll tell you, there are some rich people, too, that do find out that at the end of their lives they screw up and they lose everything. That does happen.
Well, for God's sakes, how much money do you suppose...
Ayn Rand.
Bingo. How much did she make on the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and... Atlas barked at the moon and all of that other, the drivel that she typed up. She made a fortune. But it was a social worker. Yeah, we know the story now. It was a social worker who sat down and said, ma'am, one good illness and you're toast, no matter how much money you have. And took her by the hand and went down and signed her up under her husband's name so no one would know that the great objectivist Ayn Rand had decided to go on public, you know, on a so-called public welfare program. God. How does she have any credit? How does she have maintained any credibility? Well, because she's been iconized. You know, I watched the other night a fascinating documentary called Chavolution. And it was a documentary that touched on the history of Che Guevara, but in a larger sense, it dealt with the proliferation of the Alberto Korda Guerrero Heroico image that everybody has now. And it was all about the, you know, in the end, it was all about the commercialization of the image.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, you know, I sat there watching it, just thinking about, you know, in the context of what we're talking about, you know, there's Ayn Rand who has no credibility. She's been made into an icon. And frankly, it was repeatedly said that photograph of Che Guevara is the iconic photograph of the entire 20th century, which I would say that based on reproductions, it probably is. And, you know, in Bolivia, they're worshiping him as an unacknowledged saint of the Roman Catholic Church. And that's, you know, that's on the left, and Ayn Rand is on the right. So, you know, it doesn't matter if she signed up for Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare. Doesn't matter. Because people like Paul Ryan just get to say, well, that's not how it is. Just the same way that Paul Ryan hates Social Security now that saved his sorry hide. He just didn't want to make sure nobody else gets their hide saved.
Right. And I wish Alan Greenspan would be punished, too, for his total failure. And there's another grand follower of Ayn Rand. And that guy shouldn't be in polite company of anybody. He shouldn't be showing his face anywhere. The guy should be totally shunned for his total Ayn Randian thought process on the markets, which was a total failure to just let everything just ripping and roaring without any regulation, totally deregulate everything, let their risk management systems take care of everything on Wall Street, and everything will be fine. Wrong. And here the guy still is giving speeches and still making money, just like Bill Clinton is giving speeches in front of the Pete Peterson group. If there ever was a bigger group of establishment Nazis, it would be the Pete Peterson group.
Well, you know, we started out talking about fascists. How is the Pete Peterson group not just a little fascist cabal?
Absolutely. That's why I said it. Absolutely.
You know, they want to get control of government and marry it up to corporate America even more than it already is, because as corrupted and co-opted as the government is by corporate America, for that bunch, and this is the sickening, stunning part, Andy, it's still not enough. Whoa, you know?
Right, they want it all.
They want it all.
They never stop. And just one last thing, that Netanyahu, a speech that he gave in front of the House where one of the demonstrator, actually, Code Pink person, got beat up pretty good. But that was one of the most disgraceful exhibitions I had ever seen. Can you talk about a despicable outburst of those cheers for Netanyahu, a guy who is, talk about a fascist and a war criminal and a person that has no scruples or morals whatsoever. To watch our Congress in action was just so disheartening, so utterly disheartening. Anyway.
Shameful. Yeah, I mean, that's why I kept yelling, clap, you bastards, clap! If you don't clap louder, by God, he'll make you dance for it next time.
Yeah, man, was that something else.
It's embarrassing and shameful, it is. Andy, good to hear from you, brother.
Again, on this Memorial Day, remember Pat Tillman.
Hear, hear.
Guy could have been something else for our movement. He really could have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Take
care.
All right,
Bob. Thank you. Thanks for everything you do, man.
My pleasure, Andy. Thank you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's me again.
And everything works. I'm so happy.
No, it sounds good. No, I was like, oh, okay. It's subtle barriers to trade.
Yeah, subtle. What did I say?
A slight.
Slight, yeah, it's subtle.
But
subtle.
I like.
Yeah.
No, I just thought that was great because, like, oh my God, you know, because that's every, you know, you use your barriers, this is everything that you need to survive is a barrier to the trade for these corporations. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you hit it on the head when you talk about the environment and everything else. It's just every externality, if I can use another economic term.
Love that one. Yeah.
Well, no, the externality, that's all. When I first discovered that word, I thought, are you kidding me? Or when it was first mentioned in a course I took, and I realized what it meant, I was like, I'd be goddamn. I didn't say that, but I was thinking. You know, just, you know, the language of these despicable disciplines. And economics is very dismal. You know, the dismal science, and it definitely is.
Well, you know, metrics was one of those words that I heard along the way that suddenly sort of blossomed like toadstools after a rain into the language that comes out of that same realm. You know, we're examining the metrics on that.
Yeah, and the collateral damage, you know, which is, you know, in a different realm, but it's the same kind of minimalizing horror, you know, to make it palatable, the language. And economics is just chock-a-block with that kind of stuff. But the externality, in our case, though, is the environment and what we need to sort of survive is what's at stake. I don't know if you... Another reason why I wanted to call, because they've been running these articles. Did you know that we're, like, well past the 1 degree Celsius and very close to the 2?
Yes. Yes.
And do you know what the 2, I had no idea that what would be unleashed at the 2 mark. Hello?
Oh, no. At 2, at 2, you get, it's bad, and at 2.1, you get frogs and locusts, right?
Well, yeah, and I don't mean to be, I don't want to be obtuse. I mean, maybe it should be explained. I mean, it's, they released the amount of emissions, into the atmosphere, and it's the worst in 80 years. It's just the worst ever. In lieu of the recession and everything, it's still like 50% more than they had anticipated. And I'm like, damn. And so people are panicking, you know.
Well, why do you reckon they're dismantling a mountain piece by, you know, blast by blast and sending it to India?
Yeah, no, listen. I mean, but the implications are really scary about what. And as we see, what am I saying? The implications. I mean, it's like, damn, the tornadoes and...
Well, yeah, at this point, we're past implications and into realities, aren't we?
Right into it. But the you know, and now they're saying that, oh, well, the idea that it may be four points by the end of the century, and at 4 degrees, isn't the world over with? I'm sorry. For the purposes, it's not... We can't function as a species under that regime, right? Isn't that what the scientists are saying?
Yeah, that's where basically you start talking about the, in essence, the sea boiling off.
Right. Anyway, I don't know. I just was kind of like, damn, you know. I just heard this offer from, I think it's Ecuador, where they're like, dude, you know, if you want to give us $3.5 billion, you know, we'll leave the oil in the ground. You know about this?
Yes, I do. And that's part of a growing trend that where you pay people to not do things that wreck the planet. Like, you pay people to leave forests in place. And the thing is, I watched a documentary a while back on it, and what they want to do is create another... basically derivatives market based on stuff being, you buy credits that are based on stuff being left alone, and it's bought and sold on a market.
Oh, God.
And I, you know, I just got the sweats over that.
Well, it's just, but the thing is that, you know, time is running out for that offer. If they don't hear, I guess by the end of the year or some madness, they're going to have to go to Plan B. And Plan B is allowing the oil to be liberated.
Yeah.
And so, and it's just kind of like, it's, I mean...
But doesn't this model, Sandra, show us once and for all that we are dealing in terms of the global transnational corporatists, that we are dealing with people who are at their very essence oriented on a mob-based model? I mean, isn't that, you know, like paying protection?
Well, no, I mean, it is, but I mean, I can sort of appreciate... The leader of that country is seeing...
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate it from the...
abject poverty.
From the political standpoint, absolutely. But...
And there, that is an option that... But I understand... Yeah, I know. I mean, it shouldn't even be an option. We should be fully into the renewable energy across the world by now. You know what I mean? The fossil fuel industry should be... closing shop.
You know, I have a I had a link the other day I never got to, but I have long been a fan of Ted Turner, if I can be said to be a fan of any rich guy. And Ted Turner had a piece I saw the other day where he said, "You know what big oil needs?" And then they of course said, "You know what, Ted?" And he said, the coal and the oil industries need a good ass kicking. And he's right. You know, somebody's got to, and, you know, we try in our small way to do it, to talk about the realities of what this is doing. I mean, a long time ago, John Fox made the no planet, no economy.
And the thing about, and that's interesting, you know, with the Ted Turner, I mean, this just makes me think about his ex-wife. I mean, you know, they were some tough-minded people. And I'm like, I mean, that's framed exactly how it should be at this point, because we're now talking about their profit versus extinction. And we're talking about your little ones, your grandkid, you know, my little nieces. These are people who will be here for the meeting. You know what I'm saying? We're not talking about down the road. I'm talking about these, because my nieces could live to be in their 80s, and that's right at the end of the century. You know what I'm saying?
And that's when a lot of frightening stuff will have already happened. This business with this article about Turner pointed out something that I hadn't considered in a while. But all the green energy stuff that, you know, you, me, the Horn family are kind of fond of and enamored of, and I remember Albert talking about, you know, just these crazy substances that are being developed for solar cells and panels and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there's a problem with it, Sandra, and that is that there's an urgency to getting, and of course, coal and oil and gas and those... The murderous freaks are all about making sure that nothing happens, that it doesn't proliferate, because when it proliferates, I mean, you know, economically and technologically, it becomes more feasible. So we're up at, you know, at the same time that we're talking about that 2 degrees Celsius threshold, well, we've also got another two issue, and that is that the tax credits for wind energy production expire in about 2 years. And of all the tax credits that Republicans want, you can bet they will draw a damn line in the sand over any tax credits for any wind energy.
So even less so, so the incentivization goes away, which is, you know.
Well, I think at that point it's disincentivized, isn't it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. No more incentive for where it should be incentivized is what I'm trying to say. And they want to get rid of that. But... what's disturbing, though, is, I don't know if you saw that Chris Hedges article today, is the sort of fake adaptability. I mean, I guess that Bill McKibben was saying it's all good and well to be growing swamp-type fauna in Chicago, but we're past that. You know, he said they're basing that on 6-year-old science, and sorry, but, you know, we're past that.
Yeah, the article, yeah, I saw that earlier today. Are you talking about the sky really is falling?
Yeah, and Chicago is not going to be inhabitable. Forget Baton Rouge type of environment. I was like, damn.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if we had any mountains left here, all I got to do is get the family to sit on this ground and fix the roof for another 150 years, and it's a beachfront property.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know, and they're talking within a 15, 20-year framework for either cut the emissions or don't, and it's just too bad. I'm just like, really? And it just seemed that Al Gore movie just seems so quaint now. And I wasn't that many
I know.
Years ago. I'm scared.
And but if you want the perfect example of why nothing's going to happen, this story that I was reading about Turner ends with this little anecdote. Turner's talking, and he says, and when I read this, I had to run for the bucket. I won't kid you. He said, I'm a good friend and admirer of Jay Rockefeller, the senator from West Virginia.
Oh, no.
I lobbied him a year or so ago, and he said, Ted, I can't go against coal. He said, I can't. It's the biggest employer in my state. He said, I do a lot of good work in other areas. You're just going to have to give me a buy on this one. Yeah, see, that whole dead silence thing, that's what happened to me too, Sandra.
Well, I mean, no.
Because you know how it is when you run across one of these things on your monitor, and you just sit there and your mouth hangs open and you feel like you're just some dullard catching flies? I know.
That's how I felt about the red market.
Oh, I read that, and there, you know, there's a tie-in with all of that too.
Yeah.
You know, that's the.
Anyway, I didn't mean to. You can finish what you were talking about.
But, well, first of all, Rockefeller just tells a straight-up lie. Coal is not, and that's the thing that is so godforsaken, frustrating about all this. Coal is not the biggest employer in West Virginia. You know who the biggest employer is in West Virginia?
What, the state and feds?
No. Walmart.
Well, okay. Oh God. Oh no. Wow. Okay.
There are more florists. I kid you not. There are more florists in West Virginia than there are mountain bombers. But this is the attitude that persists. You know, Jay Rockefeller wants to stay in office till he dies. I think he wants to live to be older than Bird and you know, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, this man is in total thrall to the coal industry, to the point that he'll even lie out of my congressman.
Making up shit.
To the point of making up shit. My congressman jumped out of a flying aircraft to prove his devotion to the coal industry.
And he survived.
Oh yeah, he had a couple of the army paratroopers with him.
Oh.
To pull the ripcord, but he jumped out for the Friends of Coal Auto Show.
Oh, no. Well, listen, speaking of your state and, you know, finding out new things about our wonderful country, the Blair Mountain, listen, I had no idea that it was a full-on battle with the Army, you know, the coal bosses and their...
And the fledgling U.S. Army Air Corps?
And the whole, it was just a full battle. And I don't mean to laugh, but I just shake my head because I think, damn, this country comes from such violence. And for the little bitty rights that people are just throwing away willy-nilly now, you have stories like Blair Mountain. What the hell, Bob?
And you know, the saddest thing about Blair Mountain is that it is lionized in some quarters as, you know, the great a great moment in labor history. Now, you know how I feel about how I am about being nonviolent. I mean, I'm absolutely up to my eyebrows. I mean, I am nonviolent. And the funny thing is that what in the days and weeks and months leading up to the Battle of Blair Mountain, the union that was trying to organize kept saying, you know, no matter how violent the coal company gets, do not respond with violence. Do not respond with violence. Do not respond with violence. And finally, the locals had all they could take and said, screw this, we're going to war.
Well, anyway.
And so they marched. They were marching to Logan. They were stopped at Blair Mountain. They dug in. There's all kinds of breastworks and earthworks and the old shell casings, and they shot like hell at each other, and the fledgling Army Air Corps bombed them, and Billy Mitchell later used it as an argument in favor of the efficacy of aerial bombardment. And then, after they lost, the labor organizing movement in West Virginia was crushed forever. And did not come back until FDR got the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, through Congress.
Right, which goes to the argument that unions need the help of government more than corporations, which is why the labor movement in this country has been annihilated.
Yeah, because
the government has pulled, you know, has pulled away what little help it's offered. Anyway.
Yeah, you know, 8 years of the Bush administration and the National Labor Relations Board decided one case, and that just happened to be the Kentucky Nurses Association case that said that if a registered nurse who was a member of a union had ever told a certified nursing assistant to go empty the bedpan in 22A... then she stopped being labor and was immediately a part of management and could no longer be a member of a union. That's it.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, don't confuse it with, labor and business Mussolini style. Obviously, that's not what I'm talking about.
Or no, no.
China style. No, I'm talking about, you know, having the power to organize behind you with legal protections.
Exactly.
Card check legislation?
Yeah, and the right wing made such a big stinking lie out of all of that. Card check is in the original National Labor Relations Act.
Right.
And the thing is, it requires the consent of management in order to do it by card check. For instance, most of the hotels in Vegas are organized along card check lines because the management consents to it. The thing that the Employee Free Choice Act would have done is it would have basically taken away that consent aspect, and it would have allowed a union organization based on card check whether management liked it or not.
Right.
In other words, it would have created a level playing field. The things that management can do to labor in terms of keeping a union out right now are sickening. A couple of years ago here in West Virginia, Sandra, and you know, we've got a fairly, as states go, we've got a fairly unionized workforce. We are not a right-to-starve state. And a couple of years ago, our state legislature could not quite work up the gumption to pass a bill that simply said a worker has the right, as a matter of freedom of conscience, to walk out of one of these compulsory union meetings where they talk shit on unions for 3 hours and make it understood well and plainly that you won't have a job if you vote for the union. They couldn't even do that in this state. And that's breathtaking. Because just as freedom of religion is freedom from religion, freedom of association is also the freedom not to associate.
Right.
But in this state and in any other in this country, if you work for, say, Walmart and somebody starts whispering union, well, they've got a squad in Bentonville, Arkansas, and their own Gulfstream jet, and they put this labor-busting force on the plane and fly to the store, and they start having meetings. And if you don't go to the meeting, you don't have a job. And if you try to leave the meeting, you don't have a job. And if you try to speak up in favor of a union, you don't have a job. But you cannot leave the meeting.
Yeah, I mean, and so we have, you know, no countervailing power against this corporate array. But tying it back into the environmental thing, I mean, you know, it's now the world against these people who want to make profit. I mean, I just don't really understand the logic at the end of the day. I guess they've convinced themselves that, oh, no, this isn't happening, or they can build some sort of cocoon to withstand it. I mean, I don't really know what's going on in the minds of these people. Don't they have kids, grandkids? I mean, you know what I'm saying? What's really going on here?
I think there's this sort of, and I think it's probably documentable inside liberal and progressive circles. A lot of us, Sandra, really are non-confrontational. I watched a documentary a couple of nights ago that Lottie, our moderator in the chat room, had sent me. It was called Flight of the Dodos. And the documentary was about the fight over creationism and intelligent design in places like Kansas and Pennsylvania and so forth. And in the Pennsylvania part of the story, remember that was a couple of years ago, Dover, Pennsylvania, and the school board said they were going to teach intelligent design as part of the science curriculum right next to real biology.
Well, didn't they vote all those council people out?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
They did. And so what happens is after that, there's a scene with a woman who was on that board, and after it happened and after everybody got voted out, she tells this story, Sandra, about how after it all went down, she saw one of the conservative members of the board who looked at her and said, "Well, I hope you're proud of yourself. You've ruined it. You have ruined everything. You have destroyed this town. You've broken us in a million pieces. And by the way, you're going to hell because you're an Episcopal." Because he was some sort of, you know, snake handling fundy. And the response, and I realize this is a long story that may have very little point, but it did to me. The point is, in her response, she said, "And I just stood there and I started crying because I had respected him and respected his opinions, and I thought he respected mine, but obviously he didn't." And it came, you know, there, that's it, Sandra. We have so many people on our side of this discussion whose response is to tear up and cry.
Oh, no.
When the response ought to be to get up in the dirty bastard's face and make him sorry that he said such a thing. Wear him out verbally. Absolutely give him every bit that he gave you. "I'm going to hell." Well, good, because if you're in heaven, Buster, I don't want to be anywhere near you, you son of a bitch. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely a lack of, I don't know, but, you know, I guess I'm just sort of freaking out about the whole environment stuff, and, you know, the response in the U.S. to the melting Arctic is for Hillary Clinton to rush up to some meeting to want to pass, you know, the new Free Sea Treaty so we can get access to it right away of resources and shipping lanes, commerce, commerce, commerce. And I'm just like, good Jesus, you know.
But
you're not going to be able to turn lemon into lemonade here, bitch.
Yeah, well, right. That's, you know. But that thing is replicated time after time after time. Our side, you know, Jesus, did you see what they did to Representative what Breitbart tried to do to Representative Wiener over the weekend?
What was that all about? I saw his face, and I didn't know what was going on. What was that? Was there some phone message or something?
No, it was this whole Twitter. Whole Twitter thing where a dummied up photo of Anthony Weiner supposedly bare chested in like some of those, you know, European guess your religion swimming trunks.
Right, okay.
You know, with a real good one going on. Was sent to this woman who apparently referred to him as my boyfriend Anthony Weiner, you know, and she was, you know, she's just a fan. The woman lives in Seattle, for God's sakes. And so Breitbart and his crowd of thugs got hold of it and photoshopped this picture of Anthony Weiner and then immediately broke a story. Anthony Weiner sends disgusting sex photo to innocent victim.
Oh, come on.
Way.
Oh, okay. So
and so the response is the response instead of outrage is to, you know, tear up and cry.
Oh, that's what he did? He didn't tell
him. Well, he said this is just a distraction from my job of representing the district.
Oh, right. As opposed to engaging and putting them straight.
Right, because what you do, I'm sorry, but what you do with these thugs, and I don't know why people don't understand, is, you know, you get in your face. You know, David in Tennessee just wrote in and said the woman in Pennsylvania should have got up in his face and said, fuck you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Sorry, little Timmy, little Cindy, little Susie warning didn't go out, but that.
No, but I hear you.
At some point in time, it's okay to do that.
Well, I mean,
because Dick Cheney understood it. He said that to Patrick Leahy, and I'm told Patrick Leahy had to buy new shorts.
Well, I mean, you know, I suppose, yeah, it's someone to be up front. I'm flashing now to that Obama picture where he's like, oh, no.
Of him and DSK?
Stay the hell away from Michelle. Come on now. Tell me that wasn't a funny damn photo.
Oh, I saw that, and I thought, I about lost it when I saw that.
I don't know, you know, I'm
because he's, I mean, it's one of those motor drive shots where it's like, ba-doo, 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 ba-doo. And so this thing has got DSK kind of halfway leading across Obama like he's trying to get at Michelle. And it just looks so bad.
Oh, God, and, you know, Obama's like, because you know exactly.
Yeah, because he's got that hands-off-my-woman look on his face.
No, and he's straight up like, she's just sort of standing there, and he's doing, I don't know, I just thought that picture was unbelievable.
No, he's kind of got an I'll cut you look on his face.
Oh, he's just sort of, no, I mean, no, he's physically restraining that fool.
Yeah.
Basically. And that's what's interesting, it's like, damn, you know. And in fact, he seems like he has to do a lot of that in Europe, trying to protect Michelle from these, you know, Berlusconi and all these other cretins.
Well, you know, I think that may have something to do with the fact that they're not quite as hung up as we are here.
I guess.
They see over here, it's she's a beautiful black woman. In Europe, she's a beautiful woman.
Right. Right. No, is it? I don't know. I just, that's, I mean, and it's not, none of it's funny because, you know, that looks really suspect. That whole case.
Yeah.
At this point.
It really does. I'm maintaining a little bit of an open mind, but it, you know, the outing of the HIV victim, you know, oh, sleazy. Because the woman from Senegal lives in HIV housing, and the New York Post broke that one. So
I missed that.
No, if it's for real, Monsieur Strauss-Kahn. May have a little more to worry about than where he left his cell phone.
Oh, God. Well, listen, that's, you know, I guess I'll let you go. I did want to mention, I'm sort of a bit gobsmacked by what the Greek leadership is preparing to do. They are going to put, the European Union is demanding now that state assets be sort of controlled by non-Greek institutions. So, no more sovereignty.
Well, I saw.
Hold, like, I guess, you know, the island of Crete. I mean, I think it's getting to be that way. So, what I'm thinking is, there is no reason the Greeks would be better off to default. What's really going on here? Why would the Greek leadership do this?
Well, does what the rest of the EU is talking about remind you just a little bit of what that goon in Michigan did with the local townships?
Well, it is like that, but what I'm trying to say is that they will be worse off doing this than if they would default, and which leads me to the other part of this equation. There is a such thing as credit default swaps. Remember those?
No, I, I've got some passing recollection, yes.
Okay. This is a story about this European madness that's coming to light. It's like, oh, okay. The credit default swaps, you know, they're like insurance to insure, and even if you don't have interest in the principal, you can still buy and bet. So they're BS, right? So you have a lot of people who have credit default swaps on the sovereign debt if it fails or otherwise. But in the history of this, in the last 10 years, this would be the first time that it would come to pass. And guess what? It's a bunch of BS. It just hides debt.
So, but if it does, there's a lot of people going to get stinking rich on betting on the fail?
Well, no. There's a lot of people who are going to, it's going to all, it's contagious. It's like Lehman's.
Okay. A real domino theory, in other words.
Right. What I mean is that it's like musical chairs, and I guess if Greek actually faults, the music is going to stop. And so the real story are these derivatives again, Bob. It's yet again the $400 trillion debt that's just sort of floating around like a bad fallout cloud. You know what I'm saying?
And none of the geniuses, where I get lost on this, Sandra, is that it's from the way you describe it, it sounds like there's a way out, and none of these big boys want it.
Right. It means there'd be some severe, you know, what they call haircut, crew cut.
Yeah.
All this sort of
for people holding bond debt, right?
Right, but it's not so much the speculators; it's the banks. That's why it's so serious.
Oh, so Deutsche Bank will get eaten,
and these French banks too. So that's the only explanation for why the Greeks would do that to themselves. You're going to put whole islands, your shipping, all your telecoms, everything in some sort of trust to be managed by the Finns? Hello?
Jesus.
So I'm just wondering if.
Well, see, and that's one of those moments why, you know, coming back around for just a second, that's one of those moments when I get some just kind of squirmy feelings about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, because he was on record as saying that that this whole capitalized, I don't even have the language for it, but it was no good and wasn't working.
Well, yeah, he wanted to emphasize more on. Looking, you know, making employment gassed part of the IMF mandate, you know, which was like, huh? So now we have Christine Lagarde, or whatever the hell her name is. That bitch is on record as challenging the French labor setup. That's all you need to know.
Oh, bus is going to stop running.
She was on record challenging the what labor should be doing in France, and was promptly told to shut the hell up. But now she is front-running for the head of the IMF. So...
Jesus.
Anyway, I mean, it's all speculative.
True. But it sounds to me like you could fairly say that the disease that is the American urge to... kill every social, the right-wing urge to kill every social good in this country is spreading. Because if you're going to take on labor in France, if you're going to pauperize poor stiffs of Greece, then, I mean, isn't it the same thing, different accent?
Well, the thing is, also, while the central bank in Europe is trying to hurry up and they want to get this sorted, because you look across the way, that shit in Spain ain't no joke. Okay, them people ain't playing. They're like, and cut, and protesting, you know, like Egypt style, called the indignant. They call themselves the indignant.
Well, and I mean, so are the Greek people just sitting still now, or
no? You know, Greek,
because it was ugly.
They have a propensity for bombing and terror attacks, so keep your eye on this space. okay?
Seriously.
You know, Greece, they had generals not that long ago. Spain was run by a fascist not that long ago.
The last remaining fascist government on Earth, yes.
Well, what I'm saying is that both those countries, you know, their democratic tradition is, shall we say, fairly young.
But their memories are fairly fresh as well, right?
Well, for Spain especially, because, you know, Spain is always touted as being an impressive democratic model from going from totalitarianism to a democratic state pretty painlessly, i.e. the elites were able to reconcile their evil doing and not be destroyed in exchange for, you know, democratic rights for the people.
But as is usually the case, isn't a lot of what we're seeing a sort of de facto declaration by that same crowd that, well, you know, democracy's great, but we got a little too much now?
Well, see, no, the problem, yeah, I mean, the actual democratic institutions in Spain are like, they're quite strong. Hence, when the bombs went off in the underground, they promptly got rid of that government. But the socialist government that replaced it made the Faustian bargain with the Goldman Sachs crowd, and the housing bubble ensued, and now you have, what is it, 50% unemployment for the young people?
And that government is teetering, right?
Well, yeah, they're done. They're done.
Yeah, David in Tennessee, by the way, noting that Madame Laguerre that you mentioned a little bit ago, he simply says Ayn Rand with a better hairdo.
She's pretty damn scary and severe. So, yeah, they have more in common than just ideology. They look the damn same. Take a look at her.
Now I'm afraid.
Well, it's just these sort of, like, severe, middle-aged European women, the kind that they try to stay real skinny because they think they could stay young, but it don't quite work.
And then they wear the Brazilian cut bathing suit on the beach.
Oh, God. Well, anyway.
Yeah, that yields those eyes-burning photographs. Right.
Yeah, anyway, listen, I have to go. But listen, you know what? You're killing me with the Steve Jobs references.
I can't see a transplant story anymore without thinking of Steve Jobs.
But you know, because I'll never forget that story about him in Tennessee. I'll never get over it. You see what I mean? Because it's so despicable. And every time I hear his high-pitched, horrible voice, I just think, ugh, you know, you're a horrible human being. Because what he did, you know, ran off who knows who's on the list by buying a property in Memphis for 6 weeks and then promptly vacating it after he got his...
Right, and this ties in, I know you got to go, but this ties in this story you sent me, and I hope to have some time for it later. I got to get hold of this book, The Red Market.
The Red Market, as opposed to the Black Market. Oh
yeah, The Red Market by Scott Carney, in which he details the desperate things that the poor are being driven to in places like India. You know, apparently thousands of people, desperately poor people, running around without a kidney.
The whole villages, well, you see people with scars on their back, you know, in the same damn place. You're like, ah. I know. And also the people who were held hostage.
The people who were kept quietly in little family prisons so they could be milked for blood periodically.
And like, the worst part is that their economic situation is barely altered after giving up organs, blood, and everything.
You're right, but isn't this just the ultimate extension of the monetization, profitization, capitalization, and of literally everything on the planet?
Oh, I know. And the thing about that article that I really appreciate, because I just thought, yeah, that's damn true. The guy acknowledged that, well, of course, people, when they're facing their end and mortality, they're going to do whatever they can to extend it. But God damn it, I want them to know what suffering they're causing. I was like, damn, just for that alone, I'm tempted to buy the book.
Thing, and it took me to this place, you know, where no longer do we say, you know, who are you wearing this year? Oh, I'm wearing Prada. I'm wearing Gucci. Who are you wearing this year? I'm wearing Sanjeev. Sanjeev's kidney.
Yeah, you know, and so it's just kind of like globalization, you know, everything is right next door. I mean absolutely everything.
It'll take a day to do it, but if I can get this guy on the air, I want this conversation.
Oh, my God. No, definitely. I mean, it's an amazing story, and I shouldn't even go here, but I have to mention it, though, because I saw the headlines, and it's nothing to do with this. The vest quit.
Yeah, old Jim Tressel. Bye, Jim.
I know, sorry.
Had to happen sooner or later, didn't it?
I was like, damn, it's about time, you know, because that was just too outrageous and scandalous. Anyway, listen, I know people must think I'm really sick in the head how I go from one. I can't.
No, they don't. No, no. No, because if they do, then it's a tacit acknowledgement that I'm even sicker.
Oh, God. Anyway, listen, I hope you, I know it's not very uplifting. But anyway, have a good rest of the holiday.
Well, thank you, Sandra. You have a good evening.
All right, bye.
Bye now. Yeah, that was refreshing. Jim Tressel, head coach, Ohio State Buckeyes. Goodbye. One of the dirtiest coaches in modern college football. But going back to what Sandra was referring to, just so that you can sort of get up to speed, it's over at Salon.com. It's a piece by Laura Miller. The name of the piece is Flesh for Sale. Subhead, From Kidney Brokers to Blood Farmers, a journalist exposes the red market in human body parts. It popped yesterday, Sunday, on Salon. Go read it. Go read it. Because it raises a million questions, and lo and behold, they tie into so much of the stuff that we've been talking about. I mean, we're down to where the global transnationals have capitalized on kidneys. How long till there's a kidneys future market? Back in the 90s, there was an urban legend about a guy who wakes up in a bathtub full of ice. And written in lipstick on the mirror is call 911 because he had been victimized by kidney bandits. Welcome to reality. And the thing is, this is one of those that almost has no answer. Well, the free market says, by God, a fella should be able to sell a kidney for whatever the market will bear, and the market will set the appropriate price. Because free market capitalism is the only hope of planet Earth. No, when we're capitalizing effing kidneys, that means that capitalism has just about consumed everything it can consume. Woof. Now, by the way, back during the conversation with Andy, Reverbo offered a celebratory ding of the bell for Andy's offering. Jay and Yuma offering up Decoration Day and extended families. Bob, my great aunt Rose, who was my father's mother's sister, was married to the sheriff of Mesa County, Colorado. They had two sons before. In 1939, he was killed in a car crash. After that, with the help of those young sons, they eked out a living on 5 acres. Then came December 7th, 1941. Both boys answered the call. Neither one came home. Aunt Rose had a bunch of peonies in her yard, which by Decoration Day were in full bloom. She had the idea to cut the flowers and take them to the cemetery so folks could put them on the graves of their loved ones. Many people insisted on giving her a little something for the bouquets. A reporter at a local paper wrote a small article about this event. My father and my two brothers helped Rose plant more flowers. From then on each spring, the paper ran a notice that Mrs. Lumley would once again be selling bouquets for Decoration Day. After several years, the whole 5 acres was put to growing peonies. In addition to my family, several cousins helped to care for the crop. This little influx of cash each year allowed my aunt to survive. Mm. And by the way, Bill, writing from Helena, Montana, says, I'm sure one of your listeners will correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall that Bubba, meaning Bill Clinton, signed an executive order in the 90s that allowed the automakers to build passenger vehicles on truck frames, and voila, the SUV was born. Really enjoy your show. Well, I'm glad you wrote in, Bill. Good to hear from you. And I think there was something like that, and that did have to do with the explosion in SUVs. And it also had to do with import stuff, and that may be where that executive order came from, because even though it was built on a truck frame, if it was an SUV coming from Japan, then it was classed as a car. And it made a tax difference somehow, or a tariff difference of some sort. About 23 minutes left in the show. We're going to go right back to the phones in a sec. Just a reminder, we roared right out of the gate, and 16 slots in those 35 that needed to come in this evening to get us to where we need to be for the end of May happened like that, and thank you very much. After that, kind of dried up. So we do need 19 people this evening, 19 people at $10 at a time. That's fine. And then tomorrow night we'll only need 35 more. So that's where that stands. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and the tab Contribute, where you will also find the snail mail address. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Wienergate, that was definitely not kosher.
Going for the toaster again, aren't you?
Well, you know, but for people who understand politics, I want you to pay attention to the fact that Anthony Weiner, I'm going to predict this, is a loose cannon. He DMs porn stars. He's been at this for a while. He has a lot of girls that he follows. And, I mean, he just can't help himself. So that's one person I wouldn't hitch your wagon to, my personal opinion.
Yeah, but by the same token, he didn't do this.
I understand what you're saying, but what I'm saying is
what it was done for was to advance that meme, what you just mentioned.
I understand what you're saying, but he was playing reckless on Twitter, DMing porn stars and all of that. That's just something that, you know, like I said, it's a situation right there that you really don't want to have faith in. I don't have faith in it.
And it'll be a shame if he gets taken down over something like this, because, frankly, I don't care about sex.
Well, I don't either, but, I mean, we've made it such a mainstay in politics, especially for Democrats, that, but it's designed like that. It's another distraction to take us away from our social ills in society that we should be focusing on.
Yeah, sure. Another see the birdie, look at the shiny thing, right.
Right, which brings me to exactly to what I was calling about. I see a lot of Obama supporters and a lot of Democrats getting excited about Republican prospects, and I just want to pose this question and actually just give my theory on all of this. I don't think you can really say for certain if you are a progressive or a Democrat that these are all the candidates that they have. To pretend to for people to write these articles and to say this is all the Republicans have. No, it isn't all they have. These are just mirage carnivals, ladies and gentlemen. If they really wanted to try, do you think, if the Republicans really wanted to try, do you think they would go down this road?
David, I think that they see a chance to actually achieve their long-term goals. Namely, to eliminate Medicare, eliminate Social Security, eliminate the entire social safety net, and basically eliminate everything from FDR forward that does any good for anybody but the rich, 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 rich. Now, with that having been said, you said a minute ago that's not the entire picture, and I agree with you, it's not, because what's being left out of these calculations, and you can't blame the Democrats for being a little bit hopeful, David, but what's being left out of these calculations is this. Citizens United. I don't care if they run Larry Craig with enough Citizens United money behind him, He can win. And so can everybody else. That district in New York looks like a big win because it was so long held Republican. But they, you know, the Republicans fought that with one hand behind their back.
I agree with you. And the other thing that's happening at an alarming rate, if you look at what's happening on Twitter and the blogs, is this constant attacking of any progressive or any person on the left who has a detraction from Obama. Democrats are constantly going after in a vicious circle. Like, this really fucking matters. It doesn't matter. And to actually spend time on this, you have to put two and two together on this one. To actually spend time on this, it really is kind of like a rope-a-dope situation we are experiencing right now. To tire out your opponent by focusing on people on the left who are really trivial. They don't matter.
I've seen some of what you're talking about, and maybe I'm guilty of part of it because I still don't.
No, you're not guilty of it. What I'm getting at is there are people. You will see people on the Twitter timeline. I want people to pay attention to this. There's the same cabal of four or five people who constantly attack similar people over and over who share the same opinion, and they constantly reply and respond and get these people silenced and shut down and just continue this whole distraction. And they do this on the blogs, they come in the comment sections, and they just start accusing people left and right. Not no pun intended, but that's what's really happening.
Well, I would be curious, and I'm not trying to keep secrets from the audience or anything, but I don't want to put anything out there that, you know, and then there's a reason you're doing it the way you're doing it. I'd be interested, just because I can think of a couple of people on Twitter, I'd be interested in an email from you to tell me who these are.
I'll give you an example. I'm not going to say names because that's the kind of person I am. But I'm saying this. The same type of strategy that you're seeing on the blogs, on the writing, on everything on the internet right now, it just looks too suspicious. The fact that we even focus on people who have a criticism with Obama and constantly attacking and railing these people, and you see the same names come up left and over and over, the same names over and over again, you have to wonder, what the fuck do these people do with their lives?
There are some people out there tweeting, and I just wonder, I mean, are there people who have figured out how to make Twitter a business model?
I don't think so, and that's the point. This, if you look at what...
So, are you saying somebody getting paid?
I'm not really certain what's happening here, but what I'm saying is there a lot, they're going after certain columnists over and over again. There's a list of columnists, there's a list of people...
Oh, I've got one that I don't like, that's supposedly on the left. I've been very upfront about it. I am very suspicious at the capitalization because, you know, I guess that's our word, you know, capitalization, monetization, and profitization of the Bradley Manning story. Because the Bradley Manning story is a very, very separate thing from the attempt to make money off the Bradley Manning story. And there are a couple of people out there that call themselves progressives who have made a cottage industry out of riding Bradley Manning's imprisoned ass.
You will get no disagreement from me on that one. But what I'm saying is the same people, and they're continuing with that story, they're continuing to make it a disingenuous argument. So you can't discuss it. That's what I'm getting at. You know, when you have someone on Twitter, and now people can pay attention to this. When you have someone on Twitter said, I just had a talk with Adrian Lamo, one of the most suspect, suspicious people, and saying, yeah, this person is a nice guy. You got to be a little bit suspect.
Yeah, but so too the other side of that, and I know what you're talking about now.
I agree with you on that. But what I'm saying is the more and more you see a focus on just that over and over and over again, that's something to pay attention to. It's not something to dismiss.
Well, some of this stuff I've seen, and I've suggested that we need a new platform, and it needs to be named Snitter. because there's just this seemingly endless stream of snittage between both sides of that argument. And I just I won't blush about it. I think David House and Jane Hampshire and Glenn Greenwald are absolute bunko artists on this story. And I have read everything I can get my hands on both sides. I think there are legitimate concerns about Bradley Manning that are very well taken and very much need to be examined. But for all the criticism that I offer of Barack Obama, and I don't shy away from any of it, that's for damn sure. I'm not going to sit around and scream that Barack Obama is the, for all intents and purposes, was the one who put Bradley Manning in handcuffs. It is his administration. It is his administration's problem. But more than anything else, it is his administration's Pentagon's problem. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I agree with you completely there. But this is but as you see more and more people who are, if you constantly see the same focus and the same attention, and I agree with you on the bunko artist and the whole story. But again, this whole focus on the whole story about torture and everything, it all has been clouded.
Oh, it's been made impossible to discuss.
Yeah,
it's become probably, I would make the argument, David, more polarized. It's become more polarized than the torture debate was under Bush, because all of us liberals, all of us progressives, understood that torture was wrong if a right wing neo-fascist was doing it or ordering it. There was no gray area. There was no middle ground. On the one hand, you had Rush Limbaugh saying, "Oh, it's just a fraternity prank," and on the other, you had people of conscience who recognized that we ought not do it. And then after the killing of Osama bin Laden, the whole torture thing erupted again. And frankly, it's very frustrating. You know, I don't think torture should be engaged in by anyone, by any American. Well, in a perfect world, David, nobody on earth would engage in it. But I especially think the United States should not engage in it. The question becomes one of, for me, the degree to which the alleged torture of Bradley Manning was turned into a profit-generating and click-generating enterprise.
I think whenever you see a story like this, and when people are constantly focused on this, and that's all they talk about on Twitter or the blogs, I think it's obviously a self-indulgent affair that they want to get their name out.
It's also a substitute for what I was talking about with Cossack the other night. It's a substitute for Goya. Goya meaning get off your ass. You know what? If you're tweeting 18 out of 24 hours a day, odds are pretty damn good you're not out in the street. Whatever it is that's worth being out in the street over, you're not, because you're sitting there glued to your timeline, right?
Well, you know, that's for another discussion of how the computer is helping and hindering progressive causes. And I would say that there is more of a percentage that the computer is not helping with the progressive cause for what you just stated right there.
Well, to the extent that the computer and so-called information sharing platforms are a digital form of what Aldous Huxley called soma in Brave New World.
Right.
Well, to the extent that it's digital soma, I think it fits some people's agenda quite nicely.
I mean, it gets you so distracted. Like people who have dedicated their lives to like online games, like World of Warcraft, and sell their homes and stuff like that. We're definitely heading down that path, or we're already at the end of that path. We really don't know where we're at right now because the line is so blurred.
It's, yeah, you mean the line, but if I understand
the
correctly.
When I'm talking about there's so many mirrors now and there's so many distractions. And just like what you said with that Wienergate, it gives you an indication of how fast stories can go off and running and get you off the subject of what you're after for the causes that you're passionate about. And the right wing is so good at this. They're so amazing and so diabolical at that because, basically, it's the fact they never give in to the fact that they did something immorally wrong. They never apologize.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
apology not being in the lexicon for some quadrants of what you're describing.
I did just want to end this on a great note that I think you'll find interesting. Apparently in Egypt, they just brought back 3 shots of the Chamber of Secrets and the Great Pyramid.
Oh, really?
First time in 4,500 years, you get a floor shot, you get a wall shot.
Cool. I saw a story the other day that said... remote imaging from like space, has uncovered something like 3,000 unknown pyramids.
Wow!
You know, just covered in the shifting sands over the aeons and the eras, and you know they're not 3,000 pyramids of Cheops.
I'm gonna have to look into that. And just one final note, I think if when they fire that Hawass guy. They need to start getting out a little bit of dynamite and put it in the shaft so they can get that robot all the way in. That's my personal feeling.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, get that stuff out of the way.
Get it in there, because I don't think they can. I think they've hit the end, and there needs.
Zahi Hawass is just. I've seen him on so many documentaries. He's such a camera stoot.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch him. But anyways, Bob, great talking to you, and I look forward to whatever else the week entails. And one last thing, R.I.P. to Gil Scott-Heron.
I was about to say, I want to make sure that is how we ended this evening.
One of the great songs of our time, and for people who think that he was just a poet, should actually look into his work with Brian Jackson, who's an amazing keyboardist to Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock. And what's amazing about it is the fact that Gil Scott-Heron was transformed from being a poet and a writer, which is already an amazing accomplishment in itself, but when he found the musical voice of Brian Jackson, he became an effective songwriter.
Well, and in reading the bio, I was also impressed by the fact that from age 2 to age 12, he lived with his grandma in Jackson, Tennessee, and that's where he learned to play the piano. Southern connection comes through again.
Yeah, Southern indeed. Well, anyway, Bob, great talking to you.
All right, take care, David. Bye now.
All right, later.
Yeah, let's take a minute before we go for this. I hope I've got good audio.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in 4 parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lights of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news.
That rises, and I'm sorry, we're running out of time, that rises to the level of prophecy. Go listen to it on YouTube. He was talking about in 1971 things that are reality in 2011. 40 years ago. Thanks, everybody. I hope you had a happy Memorial Day weekend. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, from Lottie, our chat room moderator, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, Ben Birch, John Fox, Reverbo, Matt Osborne, thanks. And thanks most of all to those of you who contribute to keep this all on the air, because it's the only way it happens. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.